we have a relationship they're interested in. So I think it's incumbent on us that we develop that, continue to develop that opportunity.
Governor Walker and a delegation of Alaskans prepare for a trade visit with China. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska distilleries are allowed to once again serve on-site drinks.
The rules have been confusing up until now. Some regulations were put in place but weren't actually enforced.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
Tomorrow, dozens of Alaskans are headed to China. They're part of a trade delegation spearheaded by Governor Bill Walker called Opportunity Alaska. The 10-day trip puts a spotlight on the state at a time when the trade talks between the U.S. and China are tense. Rasha McChesney from Alaska's Energy Desk will be reporting on the trip from China. Hi, Rasha.
Hello, Lori.
So you're getting ready to leave for China tomorrow, correct?
Yes. The bulk of the group is flying out on Saturday and we'll arrive in Chengdu early Monday morning. Then there are lots of short flights. We'll be traveling between three major cities, Chengdu, Beijing, and then Shanghai.
So are you ready for your trip?
Not quite, but I am getting there. And of course, I'm not the only one. I spoke to the governor about his preparations.
Are you packed? Have you packed? Are you
ready? I have not packed quite yet, but I will between now and when I depart.
So I'm not the only one.
Rasha, tell me more about this trip. What else did the governor say?
So this is a really interesting time to be taking a trade delegation to China. And this is something that Walker told me is on his mind. Alaska is a piece of a larger geopolitical puzzle right now. There's this sort of tit-for-tat trade dispute happening between the U.S. and China. Both sides have imposed tariffs, and they're threatening more that could cost billions of dollars. And China is the United States' largest trading partner. And last year, we had a $375 billion trade deficit. That means we pay for far, far more of their imported goods than they pay for ours. And President Trump says he wants to cut that deficit in half.
And Alaska helps by selling more goods to China?
Exactly. China is Alaska's largest export market. The state sells more goods to them than anywhere else. Right now, China is primarily buying Alaska seafood, but there are also mineral exports like gold from the Kensington Mine in southeast Alaska. Walker says if some of these businesses in the trade delegation can reach deals to sell more goods to Chinese consumers, the state can play a role in reducing that national trade deficit. Here's what he told me yesterday.
I think it's our obligation. We have resources that they're interested in. We have a relationship they're interested in. So I think it's incumbent on us that we develop that, continue to develop that opportunity. So I think it's absolutely the right thing to do. I think that the upside far exceeds any potential downside.
What does he mean by downside, Rasha? What could go wrong?
Well, in the same way that Alaska's trade relationship with China could affect the rest of the country, the federal government's trade disputes could have an outsized impact on Alaska businesses. We saw reports in mid-March about the impacts of the Trump administration's steel and aluminum tariffs. In southeast Alaska, boat builders started seeing their costs go up, in some cases by 50 to 60%. So there's this looming threat. If there were tariffs imposed on seafood or natural resources for China, that could have a big impact. It's not like the state is striking off on its own, though. Walker says he's had conversations with the U.S. Secretary of Commerce about the trade mission, and he plans to brief him on what the state got done. Walker says he's also consulting with the U.S. ambassador to China, who is supportive of the mission.
All right, great. Thank you, Rasha. Anything else?
No, not right now. I really have to go pack.
All right. Well, we'll let you go and talk to you next from China.
Thank you so much, Lori.
Rasha McChesney is a reporter for Alaska's Energy Desk. The Alaska legislature gave distilleries the green light to continue serving cocktails last week. The move was made through a last-minute amendment after major legislation that would have overhauled the state's alcohol laws was killed. It comes after months of uncertainty for manufacturers throughout the state. KHNS's Abby Collins reports.
Skagway's one distillery, Skagway Spirits, will mark its first anniversary in June. Lucas Hager's family owns the business that started serving drinks just as confusion began developing over the practice of mixing cocktails in tasting rooms. A new interpretation of the law that allows tasting rooms to operate by the state's Alcoholic Beverage Control Board called into question whether mixed drinks could be part of that operation. Hager says he has, quote, mixed emotions about the legislature's clarification.
Definitely frustration. To one degree or another, but we're happy that we're still able to mix cocktails at this moment, and are hopeful that in the next session things will go a little bit more smoothly and we won't have so many things just kind of coming out of left field.
The new language came through a last-minute bill amendment by a lawmaker and beverage dispensary license holder. Fairbanks Democratic Representative Adam Wohl offered the language after legislation known as SB 76 that would have overhauled the state's alcohol laws was taken off the table for now. The bill was killed after a move by some legislators to reduce the amount breweries and distilleries can serve in tasting rooms. That was introduced in the House Labor and Commerce Committee, where Wohl is vice chair. Wohl says when SB 76 failed to move through the legislature, he looked to address the cocktail issue elsewhere.
I really thought Title IV was going to pass with the cocktail language on it, but since it didn't, I told people I would do my best to get cocktails out there, and that was the best place to do it.
His amendment was ultimately included in a surprising place, in SB 45.
Which is a contractor's sort of licensing bill, and because they all had licensing in them, the amendment was able to be put on there.
The new language allows distillery license holders to combine the distillery's product, alcohol manufactured on site, with other ingredients. It specifically mentions mixers, liquids, or garnishes. It does not allow distilleries to serve drinks mixed with alcohol not produced on site. That means drinks like Manhattans or martinis made with vermouth are still off the table. Pete Hansen is president and CEO of Alaska Char, Cabaret, Hotel, Restaurant, and Retailers Association. He says he sees the new language on cocktails as a necessary clarification.
The rules have been confusing up until now. Some regulations were put in place, but weren't actually enforced, and people have been confused as to what can actually go on. So frankly, this needed to be clarified. It's a good thing that it's clarified, and distilleries can essentially go on what they've been doing already.
Hager from Skagway Spirits says his business is looking ahead to when Title IV comes back to the legislature.
We're hopeful that we'll get the support that we need from our lawmakers and legislators to help grow this business, because that's what we want. We want to be able to contribute to our community and to the economy of our state.
For now, the state's 10 distilleries are cleared to continue shaking, stirring, mixing, and selling most cocktails. Reporting in Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after 75 years, descendants from the village of Attu return home.
Something I never, ever expected to happen in my lifetime, to make it all the way there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
The state is set to receive millions of federal dollars to combat illegal drugs after a recent high-intensity drug trafficking area designation. Alaska is the last state to get the designation, which allows access to a total nationwide funding pool of $250 million. Public safety officials say the money will help facilitate collaboration between federal, state, and local law enforcement. It remains unclear how much funding Alaska will receive or when it will be available. Governor Bill Walker announced the designation and touted his administration's public safety action plan during a press conference today. Walker, who is running for re-election this year, was flanked by more than 30 officials from various law enforcement agencies. He says the state is in a position where it needs to rely more on federal resources for drug enforcement programs.
In the past, we haven't, and we haven't gone after some things that perhaps we should have gone after. So it's a matter of I think, prioritizing. You know, applying for grants takes time. It's a lot of work, and we're applying for lots of grants and lots of different funding from the federal government. So, yeah.
Despite that increasing reliance, Walker says he appreciates the state legislature's recent action to fund certain requests under his public safety plan.
Not just funding, but also specific positions for different prosecutors. And so I think that they recognized the need, the urgency of it. So I think they did the right thing on that. We could always use more. We'd always appreciate more. But we'll celebrate what we have.
The legislation includes money to hire 5 new state prosecutors and $12 million to fight drug abuse. 2 more candidates have joined the race for the state Senate seat representing Juneau and other northern southeast communities. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Jesse Keel is the latest to announce his intentions. The Juneau Assembly member tossed his hat into the ring at a Thursday campaign rally across the street from the Capitol.
I'm here today to make it official. I am running for Senate District Q to represent Juneau, Haines, Skagway, Clukwan, Gustavus, and Excursion in the Alaska State Senate.
Keel resigned his job as an aide to incumbent Democrat Dennis Egan the day before he announced his plans. Egan is not seeking re-election. Keel is a Democrat and will be on the party's August 21st primary ballot, but he said he would consider working with Republicans if he's elected.
I think coalitions are a great opportunity to work together for Alaska. I worked as a staffer in a bipartisan majority, and I think that's a fabulous opportunity. I'll pursue that actively.
Another recently announced Juneau Senate candidate is Don Etheridge. The longtime labor leader and lobbyist served one term on the Juneau Assembly about 20 years ago. He's been an active member of Juneau's Docks and Harbors Board. Etheridge is a nonpartisan candidate who will skip the primaries and run in the November 6th general election. He says not being a party member will make it easier to get things done.
You can't just go in there with a locked-in position and not willing to work on issues. And as a longtime negotiator with the unions, you learn how to do that.
Like Keel, Etheridge listed fighting crime and boosting the economy as priorities. He's also focused on improving unemployment benefits.
We spend millions and millions of dollars every year training workers to do these jobs. And then when we have a big downturn and they can't afford to stay here and they start going south, a lot of times they don't come back.
Fisheries Corporation CEO Larry Cotter is also a candidate for the same Senate seat. The nonpartisan will only run in the general election. Cotter announced his political intentions in late January. Other candidates could also join Juneau's legislative races. The final filing deadline is June 1st. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
The Alaska Marine Highway System's new ferry, Taslina, tasted water for the first time on Wednesday afternoon. Workers floated the nearly completed vessel at the Ketchikan shipyard and tested for water tightness in anticipation of upcoming sea trials. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Floating a new ferry for the first time is a painstakingly long process that involves bursts of activity followed by a lot of waiting around and listening to the hum of machinery. Lucky for everyone, it was a sunny day. Sierra Callis is the shipyard's workforce development specialist. She used to work on the shipyard floor and helped build the Taslina.
I started construction on the Taslina in my career. I was in a bulbous bow on January 20th of 2015.
The bulbous bow is the bulb-shaped hunk of metal that sticks out the front of large vessels. Talking in a shipyard conference room while crews were still preparing for the big, slow event, Callis says the day went smoothly.
Today is the big, exciting day in the shipyard that we've been waiting for the last couple of years. We're putting the Taslina in the water.
It all started early in the morning. The Taslina was disconnected from all power sources, then rolled onto the dry dock. By mid-afternoon, they were ready to start lowering the ship.
You have wing walls in both walls of the dry dock. It's equipped with pumps and valves, and upon dock operator's call, the valves are opened. Both sides, port and starboard, start to fill up with water, sinks the entire structure to the bottom, and that's when we figure out if the Taslina will float, which it will.
And it did, but it took a long time to get her in the water. It was around 3 p.m. when the dry dock started to almost imperceptibly descend. Around 2 hours later, she was floating. Calla says that's when they do thorough watertight tests to make sure all the welds are good. Then they have some finishing touches before sea trials.
We have hydraulics put in already, and the bow needs to have some painting completed. Just the minor little things that really finish a product up, so cosmetics mostly.
Southeast Conference Executive Director Robert Venables was in Ketchikan for another event and stopped by the shipyard to see the Taslina on the water.
Oh, this is exciting on a number of different levels. Number one, you know, of course, for the Marine Highway System to have the newest edition of the fleet. But on another level, it's just really exciting to see how Ketchikan as a community has come together in a transformation of industry to see that we can actually construct these vessels right here in Alaska. It's just a great day for everybody.
Venable says he hopes the Taslina will be able to start some kind of service this winter. The Taslina is one of two ferries Vigor is building for the state. The Hubbard is the second and is still under construction. According to the original contract, both ferries were due for delivery this fall. The Hubbard will be late. The two day-use ferries will be virtually identical and will serve the Lynn Canal area. The vessels have no staterooms or crew quarters. They'll have a passenger capacity of 300 and will be able to take up to 53 standard vehicles. There are plans in the works for a big christening ceremony for the Taslina on July 14th. Venables also is a member of the state's Marine Transportation Advisory Board. He says the MTAB will have its regular meeting in Ketchikan the day before the christening so members can stay to attend the ceremony. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, closure. 75 years after Japan invaded the furthest tip of America and Alaska's Aleutian chain, survivors are returning home. In 1942, there were 44 people living on Attu Island, nearly all Alaska Natives. They were taken prisoner and interned in Japan, where half of them died. After the war, when they were brought back to Alaska, the federal government forbade them from returning home because there were not enough people to repopulate the island. Until now. KUCB's Zoe Sobel accompanied a group of 11 descendants visiting their ancestral home for the first time.
Almost no one gets to visit Attu Island. The only way to get there is by boat. It's a long journey. The island marks the westernmost point of the United States. and navigating the governmental red tape that regulates the island is a logistical nightmare. But in the middle of a busy summer field season, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made time to ferry Attu descendants back to their ancestral home. On the RV Tekla, the main hangout is the galley.
It was something, I think, something I never ever expected to happen in my lifetime, to make it all the way there.
Crystal Dushkin is the mayor of Atka. She grew up steeped in Unungan culture. She's eager to see the old village site where her great-grandmother Mary Prokopieff grew up. Had World War II not happened, she could have grown up there. But in June of 1942, the Atuans' lives were changed forever when Japanese soldiers landed on the island and captured all 44 residents. They were taken to Japan and held as prisoners of war. Nearly half of them died, many from malnutrition and starvation. After the war, the U.S. government didn't allow the Atuans to return home. Many settled in Atka, but others never returned to the region. A handful went to an orphanage, and some ended up in the Pacific Northwest in hospitals. That includes Teresa Deal. Raised by two white parents in Washington State, she never really learned about her birth mother's life on Attu or her captivity in Japan. But she always got questions about her background.
They think I'm Polynesian. They think I'm Mexican. They think I'm all sorts of stuff. And then they tell them, no, I'm from the Aleutian Islands. And then you get the blank stare. And so they get a lesson in geography when they meet me.
Now, this is her first time in the Aleutians, her first time being close to the history of her mom's family.
I wish I even knew more about the culture so that I can tell my sons about the culture. My sons know that they're Aleut, but they know less than I do.
For the descendants, the days spent on the boat felt like a big family reunion. After 2 days of travel, it was time for the part of the trip everyone was anticipating.
We're here. We made it. We're getting ready to land on Attu. Very exciting. If I could dance, I would totally dance right now.
The old Attu site lies in a protected cove encircled by lush green mountains. The grasses grow long and wild, interspersed with purple and yellow flowers. But there's no sign of the former village. Christine Keel heads to shore. She was raised in Washington State. Her mom, Agnes Prosoff, was from Attu, but she died when Keel was 9. Keel says she grew up without any exposure to the culture. No subsistence, no traditional dance or dress, nothing. Now, she's the only one in her family to see where they come from.
And I'm bringing dirt back to my sisters. So they're going to be able to touch that to you, too.
Keel carries a big plastic bag that she's filling with sand, rocks, and other treasures of the past. As she goes, she's joined by Teresa Deal, the other descendant who grew up outside Alaska. While walking the beach, they start to unpack some of the complicated emotions this trip has brought up.
It makes me angry because...
Right, because our lives were also stolen, not just their lives.
Very stolen, and I don't believe in racism or passing judgment, but it's been really hard to not be angry at the Japanese for taking her. They were just here minding their own business, living their lives.
Now, did your mom teach you that, anger at the Japanese, or just you?
No, I think it's just me. If she did teach it to me, I was too young to remember. Yeah. It's really hurtful.
Yeah.
And I know that they were just doing their job, but...
Because my mom, she taught me... We had to feel empathy for the Japanese internment because it was just wrong. You know, the Japanese internment, that was even more cruel, I think, than our parents as prisoners of war.
Both of them agree that hate isn't productive. Deal says she made a conscious choice not to hate the Japanese. Instead, she feels sad for them. For Keel, she realizes that her mixed emotions stem from loss.
There's a million thoughts going through my mind because I've wanted to step foot on this island since my mother had died, and I really feel that she died as a result of the war. She became an alcoholic, she was an anorexic, and that ultimately took her life.
But spending time with other Atuans, Keel says, is exhilarating. Deal says it'll be hard to immerse herself in the culture living outside Alaska, but she's hoping to return for a regional culture camp and learn more about her heritage. For AK, I'm Zoe Sobel.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Bruce Schindler in Skagway. Schindler moved to Alaska in the 90s and is a mammoth ivory carver.
I went to school at the University of Washington, and to pay for school, I fished in the Bering Sea for a couple of seasons. And when I graduated, I decided to come to Skagway to drive tours for one summer and just never really went back. I went back down to Seattle to work that winter, and my friends had moved on. I was no longer a student, and I just found I didn't fit in as well as I thought I did. So I came back up here and felt at home and just made it my home. When I came here, I discovered ivory carving, and I thought, that's a cool hobby. And so I found a couple of artists who were willing to teach me a few things. I worked for a guy named David Present, who had a gallery in town, and I made 600 pair of cabochon earrings that winter and worked my fingers to a bloody pulp. But it was fine. I was learning and I was very happy. And it was the first time I was able to actually make something that really had value to it. So here buying a product that was made by somebody that you can meet when you're in Skagway, and it's a pair of earrings, but the earrings has its own story of the animal that went extinct, you know, 35,000 years ago, but survived in the alpine tundra for 35,000 years. In Skagway, most people here were not born here. They're travelers. They graduated from college, they came here to drive tours for a summer, and eventually they stayed. And so we're a population of people who've made a conscious choice to make Skagway our home. We take a lot of ownership in this town. We take a lot of pride in this town. And it's great being a part of a community that knows what it's about. Yeah, we're a tourist town, but we've got a lot more depth than just selling trinkets in a tourist, you know, in a jewelry store.
Bruce Schindler lives in Skagway. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Zoe Sobel, Abby Collins, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Rasha McChesney and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Abby Collins in Haines, Casey Grove in Anchorage, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA. Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.